It is 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. This is Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. A lot to talk about today. We have Kyle Wingfield, who is, of course, columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays. What do you got for us tomorrow? What will we see in the paper?
A few reasons for a Trump skeptic turned Trump optimist like myself to have some hope in the coming months.
All right.
So, a few things to look for.
We'll look for that in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Right. Dr. Andre Gillespie, Emory University Professor of Political Science, thank you for being here today.
Always glad to be here.
Andre, and Patricia Murphy is back with us. She writes a column for the Daily Beast, for Roll Call. In fact, at some point today, we're going to talk about one of your columns, because we'll talk about health care.
Okay.
And you suggested about a week ago in a column that the Democrats have as much to lose at stake, possibly, as Republicans in this debate. I thought that was fascinating. We'll get to that.
Thank you. So my thinking has changed slightly, so I'll update
okay.
you.
Oh, good. We'll watch it evolve in front of us. A quick piece of news. We've just gotten a wire. You may have heard the news this morning that George H.W. Bush, President Bush 41, was admitted to a hospital in Houston. The first reports were that he was resting comfortably. Within the last hour, the hospital has announced that, in fact, he did have to go under anesthesia. They had to clear his airway. He apparently has pneumonia. He is 92 years old, and we've also just learned that as a precautionary measure, Barbara Bush has been admitted to the hospital too. So we will watch and see how that develops. And the other quick thing to point out before we get going here is that in about 10 minutes, President Obama is expected to begin his final news conference as president. And as he says things that we believe we ought to talk about, we will bring them to you as we go. But let's start. We're very pleased to have with us Ambassador Andrew Young. Andy, you and I have known each other for many years. I always ask this. We call each other by first names, and you're not insulted by that.
Not at all.
Okay, good.
We call each other more
first names. Well, over the years, yes, we definitely have. So we wanted to get you to come in, and we'll open this up to everybody. You know, the Trump-John Lewis feud, for whatever reason, just isn't quite dying out the way that I think many people felt it would, that it would come and go. But as recently as a Fox News interview yesterday, Trump was still going after John Lewis. Let's listen.
Congressman Lewis is saying he didn't remember that he skipped that inauguration.
He conveniently doesn't remember. How do you forget if you go to an inauguration? I can tell you when I was at the inaugurations, and you don't forget something like that. So he got caught, and it's pretty bad. And it's making him look bad, frankly. And I think for him to have grandstanded, because I think he just grandstanded John Lewis, and then he got caught in a very bad lie. So let's see what happens.
Trump was pointing out the fact that John Lewis had said this would be the first inauguration he'd miss. In fact, it isn't. Trump tweeted the other night that John Lewis actually didn't attend Bush 43's inauguration because he was upset about the way in which the Supreme Court of the United States intervened and put that election to bed in favor of George W. Bush. But Andy Young, you actually got a call on the King holiday. I think you were in Nashville giving a talk, preaching, and Trump called you. Tell us why he called. What was the call all about?
Well, we've been working through the Drum Major Institute, which is Martin Luther King III's organization, about trying to make it easier to vote, and the whole idea of a voter ID card. Now, a voter ID card should not be necessarily just for voting, but everybody needs identification in this society. And so we've actually been working on making identification easy for poor people.
This would be a free ID.
A free ID. And in fact, we were talking about doing it in connection with a Social Security card. Mm-hmm. But actually, my foundation has gotten involved with the Indian Aadhaar card, which is 10 fingerprints, a dual iris scan, a barcode, a picture, a signature, and it has, they've done it for over a billion people, and it's hack-proof.
Okay, but in the aftermath of the feud going on, Donald Trump, you know, many people would say John Lewis started it. He said he wasn't going to the inauguration because Trump was not a legitimate president, whatever. But then Trump chose to fire back and attack Lewis. So in that context, he calls you up on the King holiday. Clearly, he has it in mind, I assume.
Well, I was they were expecting me to be there with them. But I already had an engagement in Nashville, and I told them I couldn't
come.
Did
he talk to you about about John Lewis?
He didn't.
Not at all?
Not at all. And I raised the question of John Lewis, and I sort of apologized. I said, John Lewis is a saint. I said, but we're all kind of disillusioned right now because none of us were prepared for this victory. I said, but don't worry, we'll get along. Now, I had the privilege of going down to his place with Maya Angelou for her 80th birthday. And it was Maya Angelou and 100 of her closest friends. They were probably two-thirds black. And we had a wonderful weekend there. And it ended up with a gospel brunch where everybody was religious and happy. And I said, that's the way I'd like to remember our relationship.
Your relationship
with President-elect Trump.
Okay.
And I said, he said, if ever you want to talk to me about anything, call the White House. And I said, well, I'd really rather deal with you down in Florida.
It's warmer down there.
In a kind of unpolitical way, because...
Okay.
I don't want to get caught in a Democrat versus Republican.
But did you anyway, given that there's this feud and that there are
people... Well, in the first place, it's not a feud.
Well, okay.
No, and let it go. And what I said is what I said at the breakfast. I said, you know, that I would not be in the South were it not for John Lewis. I was living in Long Island. We just bought a home, and I had a good job with the National Council of Churches. And then all of a sudden, the Nashville sit-in story comes on. And my wife says, it's time for us to go home. I said, we are home. We just bought this house. She said, no, we have to sell this house. I said, why? She said, because we need to be back down home.
Yeah. Gene was really responsible after seeing the Nashville store for getting you back, getting you engaged.
But it was John Lewis and Bernard Lafayette and James Bevel and Kelly Miller Smith, and it was the movement. Hmm. And she said, quit your job, sell your house, we're going back to Georgia.
Andra?
You know, I think some of the things that Ambassador Young is saying reflect an ethos of somebody who, you know, was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, that there aren't permanent friends or permanent enemies, they're permanent interests. And to the extent that somebody like Ambassador Young or Martin Luther King III can have a meeting and talk about substantive issues with President Trump, that's not a problem per se. I think that there are some other issues that I think still need to be addressed with respect to this issue. So, one, I think the optics and the timing of it. Some people looked at the issue and wondered whether or not Martin King III was somehow duped into a photo op that was intended to blunt the issue that didn't. There is the issue of the fact that while we, and I'm going to include myself in this, in the media, have talked about this issue a lot, it's just exacerbated by the fact that Donald Trump keeps on tweeting about it, and it's more of a he won't let it go, because it's not really that John Lewis is saying anything at this particular point. And then there is the larger issue of who is in the incoming president's ear to talk to him about optics and the importance of optics and how much he's messed them up over the course of the campaign and making it difficult for minorities in particular to take him seriously and to not be concerned.
And you have always felt very sanguine about these sorts of things.
Well, I ignore the optics. and I try to focus on the substance. And that's what I was doing. I said to him, I mean, there's a lot I disagree with, but I said one of the things I really like is the fact that you got a Secretary of State that didn't learn about the world from books. He's been an oil jockey. He's been down in Angola and Chad and Papua New Guinea. And
so you're endorsing Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State?
Very much so. Very much so.
Kyle, you want to jump in?
And because, I mean, McNamara didn't know anything about Vietnam. Cheney didn't know anything about Iraq. They'd never been there. They didn't have a feel, see? And every president, every Secretary of State we've had, all the way back to Dean Rusk, was an academic.
So I want to pick up, though, Kyle, if I, just for a moment here. Andre makes a point that I think we need to explore a bit. And that is, you know, Andy Young has always felt the way he's talking right now. I will get along. I'll find a way to accommodate. I will make progress with people despite our differences. But going into the inauguration, the divide between the African-American community and this president-elect is startlingly wide.
Well, you know, it's certainly not helped by this, okay, not a feud, a spat, a kerfuffle, what do we want to call it, between Representative Lewis and President-elect Trump. I guess I would ask Ambassador Young, from one person who ignores the optics to a president-elect who also ignores the optics. What would you advise him if he were asking your advice on how to let this particular episode go and move on from it?
Well, just let it go.
How does he reach out to the African American community?
He doesn't have to. He really doesn't have to. The problems that we have are not black or white. There are more poor white people who are going to suffer with the Affordable Care Act's demise than there are black people. Black people in cities have managed to get around to the hospitals, and we get pretty fair health care. The people who are dying the fastest and quickest are middle-aged white men.
Well, I might clarify that a little bit. So we have seen an increase in mortality rates amongst this population. But if you look at general life expectancy rates, blacks still lag whites. And you can still look at neighborhoods or zip codes where you're looking at lower life expectancy rates by zip code. And those are correlated by economics, but they're also correlated by race as well. So while I definitely don't want to not provide health care for poor white people and to make sure that they recognize that when people are talking about health care for poor people, it's not just for black people, I think there are some differences that have to be acknowledged and perhaps targeted in a remedy.
You know, Patricia,
that making determinations by zip code is a Harvard thing, and it does not apply in Atlanta.
But there are, because there are serious differences in terms of the zip code. So no, if you're in 30306, that's very, very different than in like 303 or 30318.
No, but I'm saying, though, that the people who used to live in my neighborhood that have moved to the north side for a variety of reasons are no longer there. My zip code neighborhood is poorer now than it was when I moved there. And so I just question the whole zip code thing.
All right, well, let's get, Patricia, I want to get you into this conversation. Sitting in front of us is one of the greatest boosters of the city of Atlanta that we've ever known, Andrew Young. He has promoted this city around the world for decades. He got the Olympics here, for goodness sake. So when a Donald Trump tweets about crime-infested Atlanta, poverty-stricken Atlanta, you'd think the first guy who'd be howling with protest would be the former mayor, Andrew Young.
Well, it leads to my question. And I grew up here in Atlanta. I remember your mayorship very well, with very fond memories. The city was really thriving at that time and continues to because of that leadership, I really do believe. But it does get me to my question about how you think Democrats can and should approach a Trump presidency. I've never seen Democrats take things so deeply, personally, and viscerally as the things that Donald Trump says. And when he attacks John Lewis and says he's all talk, no action, every Democrat in the country almost doubles over in a gut punch. But to hear you say you need to get over it and, I don't want to say get over it.
Yeah.
Maybe get over it and work with him. How What's your advice to Democrats about what you know of Donald Trump and how they can work with him for their own interests?
No, I think that what they're doing in the Congress is absolutely right. They are being very precise and deliberate in their analysis of his cabinet choices. And that's the role that they can play. They will play. But I also think that there are large issues, like the Affordable Health Care Act has got to be resolved, or because health care is no respecter of zip codes, economics. I mean, if disease comes out, I mean, diseases will plague you regardless of race, creed, color, or your economic background. And I think that's necessary for the society. But jobs is another thing. And the reason we lost that election is nobody said anything about jobs. I'd never heard, we spent so much money saying Trump was unqualified. Two-thirds of the campaign. Lyndon Johnson had one 30-second campaign with a lady, little girl picking a daisy, and he only ran it once. But that was enough. That raised the question of Goldwater's trigger happiness, but it did not rally Goldwater's supporters.
Kyle, we're coming toward the end of our time with Ambassador Young. I didn't know if you wanted him.
I just thought that was an important point he was making there about jobs, and I do think that is, if there's a place for whether it's Trump to broaden his appeal or to find some common ground, I do think that the economic issues that he raised in this campaign are not confined by race. People tend to talk about, oh, he was appealing to the white blue-collar workers. I think he was appealing to anyone who feels like they're no longer making it in this country the way that they used to or the way that they were raised to expect to be able to. And I think that's an opportunity for him to make some inroads in some other
but
communities.
But now in Atlanta, I just want to say, we had 30% of the people in poverty when I was mayor, but we didn't have but about 1.5 million people. We still have 30% plus in poverty, and it's 6.5 million people. It doesn't mean we're not doing anything, see? It means that there is an intractable sort of poverty. But we have 2,500 German companies that moved here. I was sitting next to a guy on a plane yesterday saying that he is paying $10 an hour plus giving workers $5,000 worth of tools. Within 5 or 6 years, they can be making $80,000 a year. He cannot find people to work.
All right. We are, I'm afraid, we're just about out of time for this. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And I mention that now, Andy Young, because Ted Barfield, one of our favorite tweeters, he had a message for Andra and for me. He said, interesting how much pushback Bill and Andra are giving Mayor Young for straying from liberal orthodoxy. Mayor Ambassador Young is a giant, a true statesman. Andra, Ted wants us to hush so we might learn something from
him. Oh, I learn from Ambassador Young every day.
Of course.
I learn from him every day, but that doesn't mean that we don't ask questions.
That's exactly
No, it doesn't mean that we don't disagree.
That's right.
I mean, I think our friendship has been based on an antagonistic ability to argue about anything.
We have debated for years, and it is a pleasure to have had a chance to have you come in and be live on the show today.
But that's what democracy is.
Right. Andy
See,
Young.
And you come to truth by disagreeing without being disagreeable, and you don't have to agree. But, you know, after you leave, you said, you know, maybe he did have a point.
All right.
That's the only way I get along with my wife. I never win an argument.
Andy Young, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It's almost 2:26 on Wednesday afternoon. Ambassador Young is going to leave us now. But when we come back, we have so much to talk about. Confirmation hearings for Tom Price are underway right now. There's a lot to talk about in that alone. And education nominee Betsy DeVos. She's very worried about grizzly bears in western states and coming into the schools, and has the solution for it. It's Political Rewind.
President Obama came into office 8 years ago, promising to end the two wars he inherited. Instead, he's whittled them down.
Smart, sustainable, principled partnerships. That's how we brought most of our troops home. From nearly 180,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan down to 15,000 today.
Obama's war legacy later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
Do you have kids? Chances are good that you've embarrassed them. Those new dance moves you were practicing when their friends came over, driving them to school in that old car? Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and I don't want you to give up your groove, but might I suggest donating that old car to this station? You'll save your kids some embarrassment, and if you upgrade to a newer model, you could be the coolest parents ever. Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kyle Wingfield, Andra Gillespie, and Patricia Murphy are here. Andrew Young has just left the studio. Kyle, Andy Young, in his own way, is every bit the provocateur that Donald Trump is. He says things. There are times with Andrew Young that you think, well, he's saying it because he really wants to get a rise out of people, but he does get us thinking. You know?
Well, I think that's how you remain relevant in the public eye for as long as he has. You know, you got to surprise people.
I think, and let me get both of you in here, Patricia and Andra. I do think he, as he always has, back from his days as mayor, always underplays the tensions that come up among people, particularly racially. Mm-hmm. But he does, I think, underplay how serious that tension is right now, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what a lot of people were worried about, especially those on the left who, you know, really took issue with Martin Luther King going to Trump Tower this week, was the notion of whether or not they were being manipulated in this. And so, you know, it's a question of, you know, there lots of people have intentions to manipulate people, and that can go both ways. So, you know, I will leave that up to them to determine, like, why they made that decision and respect that. I think the question that I would still have for Ambassador Young is, great, I think he's right. Democrats didn't talk enough about jobs during the campaign. It hurt them. But when President Trump talks about jobs and he talks about black communities and he trades in stereotypes, he does not indicate or evidence a deep, nuanced knowledge of the dynamics that face these particular communities. And so the solutions tend to be overly general, presented in an offensive manner, and those are all non-starters for a lot of people. So I hope that President Trump, you know, actually implements policies that are detailed, that could actually be beneficial, that people can understand. But nothing he has said up to this point suggests that that's what we're going to see. I mean, a lot of people take issue with Ben Carson being named as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Now, to be fair, Carson's Senate testimony for his confirmation hearing talked about a holistic approach that I think, in fact, could be quite interesting. But going into this, this is somebody who's coming from medicine into sort of housing and urban development. And some people were looking at it as like, just because you're black and just because you grew up in an inner city doesn't necessarily qualify you to lead this big apparatus that deals in policy.
Patricia, you've been spending a lot of time on the Hill recently. What is it? You mentioned how the Democrats are, you know, kind of in disarray. What is the atmosphere like up there right now? And not just Democrats, Republicans trying to figure out what the heck Trump is saying about this and that and moving forward.
It's like four funerals and a wedding. It's like most everybody is really depressed. And there's one group of people who are thrilled and can't even believe their good fortune. They've landed a billionaire. How do they do it? And, you know, a lot of people are... I think there is a broad agreement that things needed to change in Washington, certainly outside of Washington. We can all tell that. But even when you're inside Washington, the city is booming. You don't even know that you didn't even know there was a recession in 2009. If you were in Washington, there was construction. There were new restaurants. It was fabulous. And everything else was kind of just an afterthought. It's a city that needs to change and needed to change. And the political system is broken. That's very clear. So people were in agreement that there was a problem, but the solution no one can agree about. And Donald Trump is so hard to predict. People don't know if he is going to serve their interests or not. And that goes for Democrats, that goes for Republicans, Senate leaders, House leaders. Nobody just knows what to make of him. Lobbyists, it could be great, it could be terrible. So there's just a lot of uncertainty. And Democrats themselves cannot quite rest themselves into getting out of the first stage of grief and moving forward and figure out what to do with themselves.
Kyle, I think here we are 2 days from the inauguration. And this sense that we don't know at all what to expect from Donald Trump, Patricia talks about it in terms of how it affects us up on the Hill. How do you see it playing out among voters? So we know, for instance, we've seen all the polling that says he's the most unpopular, highest disapproval ratings in blah, blah, blah. By the way, I would love to get your real feelings about that because, you know, Trump keeps saying, if they don't do what I want him to do, I'll go back to their constituents. And a lot of the people who are reading these polls saying, well, he's so unpopular, who cares? But the fact of the matter is, Republicans still think that Trump is on the right path. These are not Republicans mostly who think his disapproval ratings ought to be as high as they are. So he's still got his constituents in all those gerrymandered districts out there.
Yeah, I think a lot of the nervousness or whatever that we see is because, I mean, think about the extremes of what we hear in terms of what the Trump presidency is going to be like. On the one side, you get this is going to be some kind of American renaissance, you know, that he's going to lead us on. And on the other hand, it's going to be some sort of, you know, Holocaust or something, you know, war and all sorts of the hyperbole on both sides is as great as I can remember it right now. And so I do think there's a core of people in the middle who say, look, I don't really believe either of those things. I'm going to wait and see what happens. And I guess I put myself in that middle ground right now. I think there's some reasons to be worried. I think there are reasons to be optimistic. You can choose which of those you want to follow. But you know, I think because he's such an unknown, because this is his first elected office, I take with a huge grain of salt anyone who thinks they know how this is going to play out. And I think there's something to be said for that for once.
Patricia, let's talk real specifically. We've got Tom Price up on the Hill this morning. Today he's in front of the Health and Education Committee of the Senate. This is not the committee that will officially confirm his nomination. They described this as a courtesy visit, essentially. And yet, what he says in this hearing today certainly lays the groundwork for what happens next week, right? And, of course, he got quizzed really, really strenuously by Democrats who have read a CNN story which suggests that Price, we already know some people think his stock trading in healthcare companies is unethical. CNN had a report this week suggesting he'd invested in a healthcare company and then proposed legislation that would benefit that company. Is that a fair way to set that up?
That's a fair way to set that up. That was one CNN story. There was another story that has broken the last couple of days about an Australian stock.
That's the one.
Yes.
That's the one. And Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, was first Democrat to get a shot at Price in the hearings this morning. She had a pretty feisty exchange with him in which she asked him whether he had gotten an advance tip on the value of this stock.
It was lower than was available to the general public, correct?
I don't know that it was. It was the same price that everybody paid for the private placement offering.
Well, Congressman Chris Collins, who sits on President-elect Trump's transition team, is both an investor and a board member of the company. He was reportedly overheard just last week off the House floor bragging about how he had made people millionaires from a stock tip. Congressman Price, in our meeting, you informed me that you made these purchases based on conversations with Representative Collins. Is that correct?
No.
That is what you said to me in my office.
What I believe I said to you was that I learned of the company from Congressman Collins.
In that conversation, did Representative Collins tell you anything that could be considered, quote, a stock tip? Yes or no?
I don't believe so, no.
Oh, Well, if you're telling me he gave you information about a company, you were offered shares in the company at prices not available to the public, you bought those shares, is that not a stock tip?
Well, that's not what happened.
Congressman, do you believe it is appropriate for a senior member of Congress actively involved in policymaking in the health sector to repeatedly personally invest in a drug company that could benefit from those actions, yes or no?
Well, that's not what happened.
Well, let me just say that I believe it's inappropriate and we need answers to this.
Kyle, is this damaging in terms of his nominee, in terms of his being confirmed?
I can't imagine that it is at this point. I mean, unless a lot more comes out. I mean, what we haven't seen in all these reports are the amounts of money that we're talking about, which generally are pretty small.
I think $1,000 to $15,000 was one of the reports.
I know this was larger.
Was
it
larger?
$300,000, am I right?
No,
we're
bigger.
Talking about different number. The $300,000 was sort of a group of stocks that were traded by a broker. This is an individual stock between $10,000 and $50,000 that he traded himself personally.
But the initial purchase, I believe I read, was under $5,000, and he later bought more shares
in
the
private
company.
Private offering.
Yeah, so I mean, look, I would love to get Senator Murray's and everyone else in Congress's, stock portfolios out there to see and see if we can't find some similar situations.
Well, that's precisely
among a
what
lot
Republicans,
of them.
That's precisely what Republicans are threatening. They have said, "Gee, we're going to see some Democratic stock trades."
If I'm not mistaken, the congressional ethics officials have basically said if he is confirmed, these would be stocks he needs to sell, and there's really nothing to get all concerned about up until that point.
The distinction is whether it's appropriate or whether it's illegal. Are we talking about insider trading? I have not heard anybody say this has been illegal. She asked, is it appropriate? And that's up to everybody to decide. The more details that come out, particularly about Congressman Collins' involvement in it, he bought 1 million shares and he was on the board and he was a member of it. That all starts to look a little, you have to ask questions about that.
But
for Price, I didn't hear one Republican today say this is a problem. They didn't even say this is a problem. Johnny Isaacson said, "Are you a proud American?" You know, that was his retort to this. And the Republicans have the votes.
Right.
That's just the deal.
And that's why I can't imagine it affecting his chance of confirmation. Let's be clear what's going on here. The Democrats have picked Price because it's Health and Human Services and because of the Obamacare debate. He's the one they're going after with all the ammo that they have, and that's all this is about, is trying to put a stumbling block in front of repeal and replace.
Well, I think for substantive reasons, Jeff Sessions was the bigger target because there was a lot riding on a lot of things that Democrats care about. Tom Price is vulnerable because of the fact that this issue came up. And keep in mind that 8 years ago, Tom Daschle's nomination for HHS was scuttled because of an ethical lapse that actually compared to this, some people would argue, was actually a little bit less. This was not declaring income from, you know, the in-kind services of a driver versus people talking about having made some significant money off of something.
But he's always disclosed these investments.
Right, but what this is, and to Kyle's point, this is a proxy fight about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. And the Daschle was the same thing. Everybody knew that this was going to be the president's signature piece of legislation, and so Republicans just took him down, basically. But I don't know that Price is as vulnerable because Republicans, I mean, they just have the votes.
Yeah, I mean, my point is, and thank you for that earlier correction, is that relatively speaking, of the current sort of spate of cabinet nominees, he's the one that if you had to look up like skeletons in the closet, this is the first skeleton, potential skeleton, shadow of a skeleton that we've seen. So I think people want to pounce on it.
Well, all right. So, Andra, there are some ways in which this may be the least of Tom Price's problems right now. The president-elect upped the ante a bit over the weekend in an interview with Robert Costa, the Washington Post. The president-elect said, "Well, yeah, of course, we've got all but the final details of our health care plan, and we've been working. It's all set to go. Oh, by the way, everybody gets coverage."
And I think that this is some of the concern. Like, this is the issue that I would take with Ambassador Young about trusting somebody who was yet unproven in their job, and through his campaign, where he was allowed and got away with speaking in generalities the whole time, couldn't provide details or sometimes even a grasp of how things work. So I kind of view this the way I would view the difference between knowing how to play a scale versus actually knowing how to play jazz.
Well, that may be true, but Kyle, when the president-elect of the United States, the Republican president, says, we're going to cover everyone, that sets a new standard, a new bar that Republicans on the Hill are going to have to figure out some answer to. And before you respond to that, you know, of course, Tom Price was asked about that in the hearings today. Here's what he said.
Just days ago, President-elect Trump said his plan would provide insurance for everybody. Do you share those goals?
I think it's absolutely imperative that we have a system in place that has patients at the center and allows for every single American to have the opportunity to gain access to the kind of coverage they want.
You share his goal of insurance for everybody.
It's been always my stated goal. It's what we've worked on and throughout my entire public career.
Okay. If your repeal plan, the Empowering Patients First Act, was signed into law, would you consider these commitments to ensure all Americans and leave no one worse off be met?
The goal of the bills that I've worked on here in Congress, and understanding that the role, if I'm given the privilege of leading at HHS, is different, but my role in Congress was to always make certain that individuals had the opportunity to gain access to the kind of coverage that they desired, and that they had the financial feasibility to do so.
So Trump, Kyle, says everybody gets covered. Price says, well, everybody gets the opportunity to be covered. Very different.
Well, and Senator Murray moved the goalpost a little bit there to be covered and be better off, she says, which of course will be in the eye of the beholder, I think. You know, Congressman Price, in my experience, you know, talking with him, interviewing him over the years, has been very consistent about he thinks that the law should empower people to have insurance, but not require that of
them. No forcing. Right.
And so that means some people won't be covered because they won't take advantage of the opportunity in front of them. And I think there's a philosophical question here that President-elect Trump may have glided over, which is it the federal government's responsibility to go behind you and check your homework, you know, so to speak, and make sure that you have fulfilled your responsibility to yourself to have insurance,
or is it the
responsibility to say, look, healthcare is important. We're going to make sure there's no, you know, that everyone, regardless of what type of company they work for, that kind of thing, has an equal playing field on which to purchase healthcare.
So I don't want to go too far down the road on that because we got a lot of other things to talk about. But what Kyle just said, if the federal government isn't there saying you've got to have insurance, you're going to pay a penalty if you don't, the whole thing kind of collapses, doesn't it? Because you need all those people in the pool.
If you assume things like the pre-existing conditions. Now, you know, there's another way of doing that, of saying if you've been covered, then they can't deny your claim.
Until
which
someone
is another
is
way
born
of doing
tomorrow.
That.
You know, if you're born tomorrow, you weren't covered yesterday. But this is where Donald Trump and Republicans have a real problem, is that Donald Trump says what he says, and he thinks he knows what he means, but there is all kinds of, you know, there's 10 miles between what the words that come out of his mouth and the reality that it has to get through Congress. So when we're talking about everybody gets insurance, is that everybody has access, everybody has it provided, or everybody is required?
Yeah.
It's clear he has not even probably thought about the difference. He just knows that, well, everyone should have insurance. Why is it so hard? And this has come up in hearing after hearing with all of these different nominees. He has nominees who have thought through all of these issues their entire careers in some cases, and they disagree with Donald Trump. His Republican nominees do not agree with the president on some of these key issues.
If I could real quickly, you could argue this is the other side of the coin from his Twitter fight with John Lewis, which is it's one thing to act this way as a candidate, and then once you're going to be in office, can you still get by with this lack of discipline? You know, whether it's firing off a tweet that might get you into a fight that you don't need to be in, or whether it's saying something off the cuff in an interview that you can't necessarily deliver on. And that's the ultimate thing, that if he's going to be a successful president, somebody's got to get with him to say, you're hurting yourself here.
We're going to have a lot of time in the weeks ahead to talk about healthcare, and we're going to drill down on it. In fact, next Wednesday, a week from today, Andy Miller of Georgia Health News, who knows more about healthcare than anybody else I know, is going to come in and talk to us about it from his journalistic perspective. But I want to play one more thing before we take our break. Kyle, when I told you we were going to play this, you said, I want this one. There has been a lot of questioning about how well prepared or how vulnerable the Trump transition team has left their nominees. They're coming in, a lot of them, seemingly unprepared for the questions they're going to get. And Betsy DeVos, unfortunately, was a real victim of that yesterday when she was asked, here, you know, not just by any representative, a Connecticut member of the House whose district, whose state is...
Senator, I think.
Yeah. Senator, I'm sorry. Of course he was a senator. It was a Senate hearing. And the question was guns in school. Let's listen.
You can't say definitively today that guns shouldn't be in schools?
Well, I will refer back to Senator Enzi and the school that he was talking about in Wapiti, Wyoming. I think probably there, I would imagine that there's probably a gun in the school to protect from potential grizzlies.
If President Trump moves forward with his plan to ban gun-free school zones, will you support that proposal?
I will support what the president-elect does.
Kyle, not the best answer.
Well,
and she should have known the question was coming.
I don't know how many minutes earlier, whenever Senator Enzi began talking with her, she referred to a meeting they had had, and she said, I was particularly remember this school you were telling me about that had to build a fence around the school to keep grizzly bears out because it's a problem there. And so the point she was trying to make, and part of what Senator Murphy asked her was, he said, can you tell me that you would be okay with banning guns from school or something like that? And she said, well, I think it ought to be up to state and localities. And then he said the follow-up about, you can't definitively tell me that. And I think she was trying to point out, like, look, here in Washington, D.C., we cannot anticipate every single possibility out there in the
it still made her look awfully vulnerable.
Well, it does if you missed the rest
and
of the
Chris
conversation.
Chris Murphy's district when he was in the House was Sandy Hook.
That's
I mean, that's a school she should have known about.
He is the most anti-gun senator
for
in Congress.
Reason.
I think it's fair to say. But I think she's trying to make a point that, and this, look, this is something that I think is more central to the kind of thing that Donald Trump was talking about, and frankly, Republicans have talked about for years, which is that sitting in Washington, D.C., you can't anticipate every single possibility. So if you make a federal blanket ban on anything, then if it's one school in the whole country that needs something different, you've precluded that from happening.
Andra, before we get to a break.
Well, there's a way to respond to that, and I think that this is what Bill and Patricia are talking about. So one, you've thought about this ahead of time. But then if you're saying that you have school security personnel and they're the only people who are allowed to bring guns on a school campus, then that's okay, and that's how you deal with the hunting situation. But what most people are talking about and the first thing that comes to mind for some people are people who, you know, are mentally ill or, you know, who have ill intentions coming in and mowing down defenseless children. That's the first thing that should come to mind.
All right. And I brought that up largely to say, and we'll watch it in the hearings ahead, that in many ways the Trump transition team seems to have been a little lax in preparing their nominees.
I'll tell you where the second part of the answer toward the end, where she said she would do whatever, you know, was what the president wanted to do. I think that's more reflective of not being prepared, which is, frankly, not knowing
she doesn't
what
know.
The president-elect's stance
on
this
All right.
is. That's the problem.
We're running late. We got to get another break in, don't we, Tyler? All right. Our board operator, Tyler Moore, says get a break in. It's almost 2:50. We just got a few minutes left. Let's take our final break of the show and come back and wrap things up.
On the next Fresh Air, Imam Khalid Latif, the second ever Muslim chaplain for the NYPD. When he's in uniform, strangers salute him on the street. But in plain clothes, in an airport, it's a different story.
They say, look, man, you're young and you're male and you're Muslim, and those things don't go so well together right now.
Latif is also a chaplain at NYU. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. The president has begun his news conference. He started it about 20 minutes ago. Let me just give you a couple of highlights. Jenny Ammon's been paying attention to it for us. He told the reporters at the news conference, his hope is that you will continue with the same tenacity you showed us, doing the hard work of getting to the bottom of the stories and to push us in power and this country to the best, to be the best that we can be. Clearly, his references to how he will hope the media is aggressive in terms of dealing with Donald Trump. He says he's looking forward to being an active consumer rather than being in charge of everything. He was asked about commuting the sentence of Chelsea Manning, who gave all those documents to WikiLeaks. He said, Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence. People might think it's been easy, but the fact is that she took responsibility for her crime. She got a disproportionately large sentence compared to what other leakers have received. That's interesting. I wasn't aware of that. And so that he felt that pardoning her, I'm not pardoning, commuting the sentence to time served, essentially. So
I can imagine there are a lot of inmates in the prison system who feel like they could meet those standards. For the disproportionate thing, I think Officer Manning also released a disproportionate amount of material.
Yeah, okay. So,
700,000 documents and hours and hours of battlefield video. I mean, this is not your run of the mill.
I got you. But okay, so here's the cynic in me, Andra. This comes, weigh in on this too, Patricia. This comes at a time when the president-elect has essentially made it clear he doesn't really much care about the fact that WikiLeaks dumped all this stuff, that it may have come from Russian hacks. From my point of view, there's a certain kind of little twist in terms of the message he's sending there. Well, Donald Trump, if you don't think it's bad, maybe we should just let Chelsea Manning go too. That's way too simplistic, but I can't wonder if that's in there somewhere.
My cynicism kind of went in a different area. So since Ted said earlier that I was trying to keep to liberal orthodoxy, here's where I will deviate from it. I was shocked when I heard about this commutation yesterday. Yeah. You know, I take the leaking of classified documents seriously. I think WikiLeaks is a threat to national and international security. So I have to admit I'm troubled by this. I am sympathetic to the idea that Chelsea Manning got a stronger sentence than other people got. But I really do take this seriously. And so that was kind of a hard pill to swallow. So a WikiLeaks apparently tweeted last week that if Manning's sentence was commuted, then they would let Julian Assange be extradited to the United States so that he could, you know, stand trial for what he has been accused of doing. And so part of me is wondering whether or not President Obama is trying to call people's bluffs, both Julian Assange's bluff and Donald Trump's bluff. The thing is, I'm trying to kind of work out the game tree in my head, and I'm not quite sure how this ends.
Patricia? Yeah, well, I think there's been an update that Assange's lawyer, are we not at all surprised, said, well, this doesn't technically meet our offer, so we're going to let him stay where he is. So he's not going to be coming to the United States. I'm surprised that President Obama is letting this be his last impression to the military and the intelligence community. I heard very little support for this decision among Senate Democrats and House members yesterday. They were shocked equally. So it surprises me. And I also thought maybe there's more to the story. But if there is more to the story, we haven't heard
it yet. Yeah, that's exactly right. I had the same thought, Kyle. Maybe there's something here that we're not going to learn for a while.
That's always possible. I think it puts some people on both sides of the spectrum in an awkward position, right? You've got the people on the right who have been defending, Trump and saying, well, you know, he didn't have Russia, that wasn't a factor in the election and everything, but they've been big on, Manning before and Snowden and Assange and some of these people. And then you've got the opposite thing on the left. And I think I know a few people who say, look, I have no problem with the election stuff and I have no problem with Manning. And I know some people who have a problem with both. And I think it's tricky if you're trying to pick one or the other of those.
All right. We're almost out of time. We haven't even gotten to the fact that Donald Trump got an assist from Vladimir Putin the other day. Putin says that Obama is trying to undermine the Trump presidency. This gets stranger and stranger, Kyle.
Well, what else would Vladimir Putin do in this situation? This is, if his whole goal, and I believe it is to just sow division, it's the precise thing that you would do. It's exactly what you would do. You would go and say, well, yeah, this is now the Democrats. It's their fault. And that's why I think Americans need a united front about a clear-eyed view of Russia. And, you know, you can believe that without believing that Donald Trump is an illegitimately elected president.
Sure, of course.
But I think both sides need to be very clear-eyed about what Russia is up to.
Nikki Haley said that in her confirmation hearing day. She's going to be UN ambassador, and she was asked very specifically about Russia, and she said, "Yeah, we got to be tough." So once again, another cabinet nominee who basically goes her own way without regard to what Trump has said.
This is less of a surprise. I mean, you know, Haley was critical of Trump, you know, during the primary season. She was a Rubio supporter. So the idea that she's going to stake an independent sort of line is fine. I think the question becomes, well, what were Trump's motivations in nominating her for this position? And does he know that? And I think that's always the bigger question. I don't have a problem with dissent or disagreement. That's actually healthy. But it's a question of the extent to which the incoming president actually knows how he disagrees with his advisors.
Is Donald Trump the only person in America who feels as well toward Vladimir
Putin?
That's my question,
all right.
Including his nominees.
We are completely out of time for today's show. Just time enough to give you a few notes. One of them is that we are not on the air on Friday because National Public Radio, NPR, will devote the entire day to covering the inauguration of Donald Trump and all of the attendant formalities and celebrations around it. And as we leave you today, though, we are back next Monday at 2 o'clock, Wednesday at 2 o'clock. Lisa Clark, our producer, has been monitoring the Obama news conference, and I thought she brought one thing to us that we ought to share with you. He was asked, the president was, whether he supports the boycott of the that so many now members are, some 40-plus members say they won't go. He said, my working assumption is that having won an election, it's appropriate for him, Trump, to go forward with his vision and his values. Maybe once he's in office and sees the complexities of healthcare, job growth, that may lead him to some of the same conclusions I've reached. We won't know until he's behind the desk. It's important to pay attention to the confirmation hearings. It's a job of such magnitude, you can't do it yourself. So President Obama, as he says goodbye to the country, at least in the news conference, weighing in on Donald Trump. That's it for us. You know, if you can't be with us when we're on the radio, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And Kyle Wingfield, I'm really pleased to report that Political Insider, the blog that you all contribute to on the AJC website, is now carrying the Political Rewind program. You can listen to the audio of it there. So that's really a thrilling part of our partnership.
Absolutely.
Patricia Murphy, Andra Gillespie, Kyle Wingfield, thank you so much for being with us. Tyler Morris, senior producer Jenny Ammett, producer Lisa Clark, thank you for your work on today's show. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll see you back here again Monday at 2 o'clock. Happy Inauguration Day.